honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Sometimes you hear a voice on this program that makes you do a little bit of a double take. With George Kincaid of Nuquayama, California this week, you might be saying to yourself, he really doesn't sound like he's 99 and a half years old. No, he sure doesn't. And if you ever have the privilege of meeting Mr. Kincaid and shaking his hand, you might find out that he's actually related to Las Vegas Raiders quarterback Derek Carr. George never would have had the chance to watch Derek in silver and black if he didn't make it home from his World War II service as a Marine. And when we left off, he mentioned being sent to Nagasaki just 2 weeks after an atomic bomb had leveled a good portion of that city.
I was driving dump truck then, and we had unloaded ship, and 6th Marine Division was on an airport, and you'd have to haul all the way there. And it seemed like Nagasaki, it was an ammunition factory, and every house was gone, nothing but the cement foundations, or, you know, like this house is, just a cement around, and half of those houses had a steel lathe in them. They did piecework for the factory. Well, the Army was there just before we did, and they, I think it was the Army, and they took all those lathes and put a tunnel. There was a tunnel about half a mile long to get to the mountain to get over to the airbase. So when you drive through that with a truck, there was all those lathes lined up in there. The railroad depot was right there. The bomb wiped out everything next to the airport that way, and this side of the airport, the town was okay. And we were just a couple of hundred yards from that in a schoolhouse. We lived in that schoolhouse till we come home. And I remember one day I had a little boy with a cat. And so I had to take this caterpillar to the 6th Marines. And I was driving down this rice paddy, narrow road, and here comes this Japanese civilian in a truck. Well, I couldn't go nowhere. I wasn't going to put that Army Marine Corps truck and trailer and cat in the ditch, see? So I just kept going, and he run off in the ditch. And then I looked back, and I could see the steam coming off of it. So I stopped. I went back there. It was a man and his wife and two little kids. They were jabbering away. I couldn't understand. Well, I went up and looked at that truck. It was like an old 28 or 29 or 30 Model A, but there was no Model A engine in it. Did you ever see a Fairbanks Morse with the two wheels on the side? Two big wheels about this big around? Yeah. Well, that's what he had sitting there running that truck. A Fairbanks orange. Well, in other words, my grandpa had one just like pumping his water well. Two big old flywheels on the side. Yeah, and that was sitting there in that steam. It don't have a radiator. It just had a big bowl on top of a tank, see? And the water slushing out. And that's where the steam come from. And that's what he had.
He had a jerry-rigged steam truck.
Yeah. He had that fixed there where the shaft came out and went over to a bearing on the front frame. Well, this motor set up on top of him, and he, you know, had a belt and stuff going down around that shaft. It's a weird setup, but it worked.
So were you able to help them?
No, I didn't do anything. I just went on down. When I come back, here's gone. It was an airport where they trained Japanese young pilots. They were taught to fly a glider before they got on an airplane. They had to fly this glider, see? And the weird part about it was, I built model airplanes when I was in high school, and they was all over the ceiling in my bedroom. And that glider that they had out there was the same thing I had that I built as a kid hanging on the ceiling. Yeah, same kind of glider, yeah. And they're all over the place.
You know, a couple things that come to mind. First, so you're on Tinian. This is not a very big island, and I assume news travels fast. Yeah. So when Paul Tibbetts and the Enola Gay go drop that bomb on Hiroshima, they return to Tinian. How did you find out what had happened, and how mind-blowing was it to hear about this atomic bomb that no one knew even existed?
It was weird. Yeah, it was. It was. It was amazing. But you was relieved because you figured, well, they did that so we wouldn't have to invade. So they figured we'd lose millions of people to invading Japan. So it was a good feeling to know that it was over with, you know. But then they were stubborn and wouldn't do it, so they had to drop the other one.
Do you remember how that word kind of spread around the island, or what some of the things people were saying were, or what that felt like at the time?
No, it felt good, yes. It felt good, but everybody just talked about it. It was just all, well, that's great. That's, you know, everybody was glad. It was a change of the war real quick.
Do you think you would have been part of the invasion force if that invasion of Japan had happened?
Might have been, but we would have been way later. I don't think we would have been earlier.
So you hear about the bomb on Hiroshima, the bomb on Nagasaki, and then you go to Nagasaki. You said just 2 weeks after the bomb was dropped, you were there?
Yeah, we was in there for 2 weeks.
So there's probably still some radiation floating around, right?
That's what I thought. Nobody got hurt, see?
You're almost 100 years old. I guess you're okay.
Yeah.
But because very few people were there to see what you saw. Certainly very few people are alive today who saw what you saw at Nagasaki. What can you tell us about what it looked like and what it felt like to look at it?
Well, it was amazing because you couldn't imagine anything could be that destructive because there was nothing there. Now, I see pictures of Hiroshima, and there's a lot of concrete buildings still standing. Well, Nagasaki, there wasn't none. It was an ammunition factory, and the metal framework that this factory is big is still standing, was still standing. But the covering it, the outside, what they covered it with, you know, metal or tin, Garapan, big buildings with all tin, full of holes from the bombs, see? But that was nothing. But the framework was still standing, and a great big monster smokestack was still there. Great big old, it must have been 100 feet tall or more, big 10-foot in diameter. It was still standing. But everything around for a dirt distance was gone. It was just flat gone.
I can't imagine trying to wrap your brain around that.
Yeah, that's it. It's just, when you get there, you shake your head. Boys, you can't dream of something being so powerful, and yet the nuclear is worse than it is. The ones we got now are worse than atomic.
Yeah, what's your feeling about that? About the youth? Because you saw what it can do. I mean, and you know that there were people who were just disintegrated in an instant. So how do you feel about nuclear weapons now?
I think they ought to be banned. Shouldn't have them. But you know they are. North Korea, they got them. See, they shouldn't be allowed. Well, they're trying not to have them, too, you know. Russia's got them, we know.
And then you said something else. So your birthday's August 14th, and that's the day you get the news. Japan has surrendered. Yeah. This war is over. How did you get that news? Were you celebrating your birthday? Did they interrupt your birthday party to tell you? How'd you find out?
Nobody had no birthday party over there. It's just come over the news, you know. You just hear it, you know, the radios. I never seen a radio. Nobody had a radio. They were in the office. It was all by telephone. I think the big we got the word and called us.
Well, was there a celebration?
Oh no! Well, yeah, just a lot of jumping up and down and hollering. Yeah. I guess the guys that drank. You know, I didn't drink anything. You know.
When you look back on those years you spent in the Marines, sounds like what, about 4 years you were in?
Yeah, just about 3.5.
Is there something you look back on and you say, you know, this was the most challenging aspect or the hardest thing to deal with for you?
The worst thing, the scariest thing that I did, it had nothing to do with the war, but I was driving the truck and it was loaded with ammunition. Everything from 45 to 20 millimeter, just full of ammo. I come around this corner and here was a big 18-wheeler pulling a trailer, and I had no place to go. So I drove off the road. It turned over one time. I remember laying down, wrapped my arm around the windshield, and had my eyes open, and I'd seen the windshield just disintegrate and rolled over and lit on my wheels. So if it lit in a creek upside down, I wouldn't be here. But it lit on my wheels, see? Then my .45 fell out of my holster. I had a spring-loaded holster on my armpit, you know? And it fell out, and I got to get that. And I bent down, and I just happened to reach down right to the right spot and pick it out of the water. But I had a pipe. I smoked a pipe way back them days. It's a pipe and a cigar. And a guy named Felix Caruso, he was a wood carver, and he carved this pipe, and he put the Marine Corps emblem on it, and he was so darn good that you could see the coil in the rope and the feathers on that little eagle on the emblem. And he put Mom and Dad in freehand on the side, and he put all the islands that we went to, didn't get out, but all the islands I had to stop at, you know. I couldn't find my pipe. I lost my pipe. I felt pretty bad about that. But then the next day, they brought the truck in. They went out and got all the ammunition up in the truck, and got the truck, and I went down the truck, and the seat wasn't in it. I looked in there, and there's a half inch of the pipe stem sticking up through a hole in the under the seat. So I saved it, you know.
You still have it?
Nope. Somebody stole it. We think somebody got it for drugs, you know, later years.
Yeah, it sounds like a priceless pipe.
It was. I realized his name was Felix Caruso, and his dream was to build a whole set of furniture, hand carve a whole set of furniture. I don't know whether he lived, he did or didn't. See, but he signed the bottom Kitty. That was his nickname, K-I-T-T-Y, Kitty.
Yeah, that's a pretty close call when you flip over an ammunition truck.
Come to it, see. I don't know how to swim, so you figure if the ship got torpedoed, it would be a little messy.
What was it like to come home after the war?
It was great. I got out of service New Year's Day, 46, and I got liberty and came home in December.
Did you know your wife before the war or no?
I didn't meet her after the war. After I got home, I turned around and went to Texas because this guy that drove the Jeep, the other Jeep, was a good friend of mine, you know, and he lived in Lufkin, Texas. So I went down and visited him, and I rode a Greyhound bus down, and it was such a miserable trip in that bus that I said, I'm not going to ride it back. So I give a guy $400 for a GI motorcycle, a Harley 45, no flat, head 45. I gave him $400 for it and rode it home. And my mom, my wife always teased me because I sold a motorcycle for $400 to buy her wedding rings. $400, nothing today, but, you know, I still got it in her wedding ring in the box. I was driving a 37 Pontiac, four-door sedan, and we was right by San Clemente. We had a safety latch on the back doors. You couldn't open the back door as long as the front door was shut, but the safety broke. And I was batting along at about 55 miles an hour on the freeway, and it was just about dark, and I heard a rush of wind. The back door opened up, and Doug, the oldest boy, fell out. He fell out on the highway. I looked in the rear mirror, and I saw him rolling sideways. So Mom picked him up, and there's a knot on the back of his head. There's about half a cantaloupe. So we poured the coal and drove on into Orange County to the Catholic Hospital. And they looked him over. Oh, he'll be all right. We said, what about that knot on the back of his head? He says, that's just blood. It'll go away in a few days, but we want to keep him for observation. So I says, oh, okay. And Mom asked me, says, do we have enough money to buy motels? And I says, well, I think so. And the doctor reached in his pocket, pulled out his wallet and said, you need some money? I said, no, I don't think so. So we didn't take it. But he, I often wondered, would doctors do that today? He reached in and gave us some money. And so we went back to hospital, and that knot was just about gone the next day. It was okay, and we left the money because I had to go to work Tuesday, and I got home with $13 in my pocket. So he was 2 years old and he's 6'6". That was a scary deal. And you know, it's funny about that, as we went easy on him his whole life. He never got a spanking. We never spanked that boy. I think just because of that reason. You didn't know, but it never hurt him. Knocked the skin off his elbow and his toes and heels from rolling down the blacktop. We're just like no cars behind him.
Was it him or Tim who went on the honor flight with you?
Yeah, him. Doug. Doug's the one that was on the honor flight.
Well, tell me about that honor flight. So you went with Honor Flight Kern County to Washington, D.C. What were some of the things you saw, and what did you get out of that experience?
It was great. We went through all the memorial services, and then it was raining, and they couldn't go to what else we wanted to see, so they just drove us up to the Smithsonian Air Museum. We went to the museum, and then we went on and waiting for the bus to pick us up, and a Brigadier General walked up. He had his stars on, and I'll never forget, his name was Tom Moore, and I worked with a Tom Moore out here. And he sat there and talked with us for 15 minutes, wondering all about what was going on. Young guy, didn't look like he had enough gray hairs to be a brigadier general, but he was.
What did you think about when you were at that World War II memorial, where they've got 4,000 gold stars there, representing over 400,000 Americans who didn't come home from the war? What was going through your mind there?
It makes you very humble that many people, well, they died for their country.
Did you have any friends in the war who didn't come home?
Oh, yeah, a few. Yeah, there's a couple of guys in Maricopa. Taft, the guy I went to boot camp, never came home. Paulson, a guy from Taft, he never came home. I knew a lot of guys that did, you know, different people. Guy I went to work with, went to visit him all the time, him and his mom and dad. And he was in the war and did a lot of heroic things, and I didn't even know it. I went to visit with him a dozen times after the war. And then when I die and read the obituaries, there it is. Well, a guy, he worked down Plant 10. He's a foreman. Never heard much out of him, but it turned out he was a P-38 pilot, shot down a couple of planes. But he never, you didn't know it. till way later.
Well, with that in mind, is there anything else you think we need to know about your own time in the Marine Corps?
I had a lot of fun, but yet I wouldn't do it again. You know, that's it. It's just, you know, we're lucky to be alive.
I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country.
You're welcome.
Thank you for telling us this story. When you look back over almost 100 years, 99 and a half years, is there something you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I think I remember 72 years. That's what I look back at, and I miss her horribly. That's what I accomplished. And yet I got a fistful of medals for pistol shooting all those years. Nobody around in this town could beat me.
I want to follow up on something you said there. When I asked you what you were most proud of, you said being married to your wife for 72 years.
Yeah.
You lost her 3 years ago. You said you still miss her horribly. But I want to know for everybody listening. There's a lot of people listening who are married. They might have 20 years, 30, 40, 50, but they want to know the secret to being married that long, to enjoying that many years of marriage. So I'm sure you have a good answer for me on that. What was the secret for you guys?
Tell them you love them every day. I don't think people say that enough. And respect each other. Obey, it says. We never had no fights. I'd be afraid to fight her. She's pretty tough.
And so I asked you, looking back, what you're most proud of, but I want to ask you, too, looking forward, is there anything you haven't done yet in 99 and a half years that's still on your list that you want to do or you want to experience, you want to see?
You know what I thought? Jumping out of a parachute. Yeah. I thought jumping out of an airplane. But I'd have to get a doctor's okay first, because I don't know if my cow heart valve would fail. I got an aorta valve from a cow. It's a bovine valve from a cow. They said it was good. They would last for 4 to 10 years. Well, this is the fifth year. So I don't know how, you know, you don't know. Still strong. Pumping strong.
Pumping strong. I think we can say that about George Kincaid, 99 years old, hitting the century mark this coming August. Who knows? Maybe we will get to see him jump out of an airplane. I'm just grateful he shared a few of his memories over the last hour. Don't forget to check out the photos and a short video with George at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We are out of time, but I hope you can join us again next time. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.